Morning.
Sons of Adam, daughters of Eve. I think that's what C.S. Lewis uses that in the Narnia story, doesn't he? He uses that title. So that will tell you where you came from. Yeah, I think it would probably be slightly better if we put the questions at the end. It makes the tape come out a little better. And then there's a great danger that I'll get totally incoherent if I'm interrupted too much. But lots of questions. Chapter 4, page 13. My Bible's all glued together with Scotch tape and coming apart, but I think we can get it here. Last week we did cover chapter 3, which is an extremely pivotal book in the whole Bible. One of the most amazing of all the books. Without that one book in the Bible, we'd have a hard time understanding the situation that we now find ourselves in. And death, ruin, destruction, misery, pain, loneliness, guilt, sorrow, suffering, all those things for which the theory of evolution has no answer whatsoever. Adam and Eve have been thrown out of the garden to keep them from gaining access prematurely to the tree of life, which would have imparted immortality to them in their fallen state, presumably. And the gate to the on the east end of Eden is guarded by two cherubim with flaming swords to keep Adam and Eve and their children from going back into the garden and prematurely. Picture of the cross. Now Adam, there are consequences of the disobedience of Adam and Eve, consequences for the both of them in their lives, but God's grace is upon them, and I believe they had come into a relationship with the Lord, so they're restored as we are restored, and the healing process has begun, but of course their bodies aren't redeemed. They're mortal. Maybe 100 years has gone by. We don't know how old Adam was when he was created. I guessed 30, and I'm going to guess that we've gone forward another 70 years, and they've got their own little cottage outside the garden, and they're farming and raising animals, not eating meat, but nevertheless raising animals, sheep for wool and so on, and chickens for eggs and all that stuff probably. But it's a simple lifestyle, and we're talking about their children, that we get the very first record of anybody being born. Adam knew his wife. That's yada, the Hebrew word yada, to know intimately, to have intercourse with. It's the intimate word. Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain and said, I have gotten a man, namely the Lord. The word Cain means gotten or begotten, from which we get our word begotten. I have gotten a man, the Lord, is what it really says. Very likely, Eve knew that God had promised that one unique son would be born to her, a divine son, and that divine son would be the Savior of the world. So she jumps ahead and assumes that her firstborn son is going to be that Redeemer. A little premature. But that's probably what she has in mind. I've gotten this is God's gift. Well, this must have been quite an amazing thing for the first pregnancy, the first child born, and this good-looking kid coming out. And of course, firstborn child is always very special. And that little do they know that they've brought a monstrous little murderer into the world, their first son. Some period of time passes, and they have a second son whose name is Abel, and his name means breath or nothing, or he's weak and frail, probably. Maybe even physically weak and frail. There's consequences of sin there. So Cain is certainly going to get favored and pampered. These two boys grow up together and they're homeschooled. Okay? Obviously. So they're going to get a lot of very good teaching from Mom and Dad about what it was like in the garden and what it was like to be unfallen and what it was like to have the Lord come down and talk to them, and they're going to get the whole history presented to them, and they'll get plenty of instruction. And let's see if they how well they do. The boys choose somewhat different occupations based on their interests and their skills, and Abel chooses to be a shepherd, to take care of sheep. And Cain is interested in agriculture, so he plants crops. Both legitimate occupations. No factories around yet, no high-tech industry or anything like that. So he would just, a lot of the time and energy of the family is going to be in raising food to support oneself. That's an awful lot of the whole history of mankind has been the history of devoting most of your time and energy to feeding yourself. It's only in the last 100 years we don't do that, but usually that's the story of the race. Now, in the process of time, in the course of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. So the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why is your countenance fallen?" Some people would think that the sacrifices were wrong because one of them was an animal blood sacrifice and the other one was a grain offering. I don't think that's so. Grain offerings are acceptable later on in the law of Moses. There's an idea mentioned in here of a specific place where this offering was presented at a specific time of the year, probably an annual or a regular time, like Passover. You'd come to an appointed place and offer a sacrifice to show honor to the Lord. The boys have both been taught about that, but they've both been taught about blood sacrifice. Probably the place where this offering was presented was at the gate of Eden with the cherubim there. And then, so this would have been maybe the very first mercy seat, the place where you go to get mercy from God. And there are the cherubim. And so this is the prototype of the Ark of the Covenant later on in the tabernacle in the temple, where the cherubim were over the mercy seat and the offering is presented there and you ask God for grace and mercy. So that's probably what happened here. So there's no question there's some kind of teaching about the shedding of blood is necessary for the forgiveness of sins. And these boys had been taught that the motive of your heart matters far more than the gift. And Cain had probably brought some attractively looking gift that looked really nice. And his brother brought this maybe an animal that had been killed perhaps. And so that wouldn't make a very impressive looking offering. And God reads the motives of the heart and he finds Abel's sacrifice is indeed from the heart. And it's showing honor and respect to the Lord. It shows that Abel understands how we get access to God. And Cain, on the other hand, with his worldly thinking, doesn't think along those same lines, and he just brings a token offering of something, and his heart's wrong, his motive's wrong. And God calls him on that. God calls him aside and talks to him, maybe through his parents, maybe directly. Why are you dejected that your offering has not been accepted? Now, I don't know how God would indicate to these two boys and to the family that their offering was accepted or rejected, but there was somehow God let them know that Abel's, the young, frail, weaker brother, his offering was acceptable to God and Cain's was not. But now you don't just give up on Cain. God now begins to deal with him. He's angry. He's angry because his hard work hasn't been honored by God. Well, there's a kind of works-oriented approach. You know, I'll give God 10% of what I make this year, and then he'll be happy and bless me. And that's not the right idea for offerings. Offerings are from the heart out of gratitude and so on. Why are you angry, and why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, that doesn't mean if you try harder. It doesn't mean that. If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you continue to learn from your good homeschooling, from your parents, and you can continue to understand what I'm like, then a year from now I expect that your offering will be acceptable and you will grasp the spiritual principles underneath that. If you don't do well, if you continue in the way you're going in life right now, sin lies at the door. Sin couches at the door and its desire is for you, but you must master it, rule over it. That's true of all of us. Sin's knocking on the door of your life. If you choose to have Jesus in your heart and you choose to follow God, you'll have protection. But temptation's always there in one form or another. The appeal to money, riches, power, wealth, success, happiness, that's always there. And it's something that we all have to master. And so this is the warning. Either choose me and let me protect you and guide you and help you, or the option will be that you'll have no defense against evil. It's knocking at the door of your life. Cain doesn't take this advice. The word sin here, by the way, sin lies at the door. Chata is the word here to miss the mark. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. You'll fall short of what God wants for you. You won't reach your potential that God designed you to reach. Well, Cain doesn't get rid of this anger in his heart, and it turns to murder. That's what the end result of anger is. In fact, James tells us that war and violence in the world is the result of the pursuit of pleasure. It's the result of living apart from God. Anger builds up in the heart, frustration because things don't run right, and that ends up being the source of murder and even war and violence in all of the world around us. Cain talked to his brother Abel, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Suddenly we have the very first murder. Surprise, suddenly, a terrible, violent surprise on the stage after this, the bliss and contentment and beauty that we talked about in the Garden of Eden. Suddenly, in these two children, properly raised, properly instructed, comes this violent murder of an innocent, godly young boy. And a horrendous crime in the first of a whole series of terrible things that will happen in the human race that are obviously the direct consequences of the fall of the parents. Something's been passed on. Does God come along and shout hellfire and damnation on Cain, or threaten him with punishment, or write him off, or haul him into court, or give him the justice that's immediately due? No, fortunately. If we were to ask God for justice, we might get justice, and I think we probably would all regret that right away. Instead, the Lord's approach is to offer grace and mercy and patience to the condemned murderer. That's important lessons right here. The Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" God knows, of course. He would like to get a confession out of Cain. As he had, when he came to Adam, "Where are you, Adam? Where are you, Eve? Where are you?" He does the same. God comes and asks Cain, "Where's your brother, by the way?" And we get a deliberate lie out of Cain. We don't get any passing the buck and then admission of the truth. We get a lie. I don't know. Well, he does know. Am I my brother's keeper? That's a very famous saying that we quote even to this day. Am I responsible for my brother's well-being? Well, yes, in this case you are, because you killed him. But it goes beyond that. It says, am I responsible for taking care of my brother? Yes, you are. Are we responsible for one another? Yes, we are. We can't live our lives in isolation from everybody else. So there's an outright denial. There's no change of heart in Cain here. He said, God said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." That's a very interesting expression. It goes all the way through the Old Testament that shed blood, innocently shed blood, soaks into the earth, and the earth is outraged at this and cries. The blood itself cries out for vengeance to God. Think of how blood-soaked the whole planet is, and all the innocent blood that's been shed down through history, and all of the number of innocent lives that have died, crying out to God for vengeance, for revenge, for justice. The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground, and I, God being just, I have to be just. I can't ignore this problem. Now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it will no longer yield its strength to you. A fugitive and a vagabond, you will be on the earth. Now his sin's not forgiven because he hasn't asked for forgiveness. He gets nevertheless consequences for his actions, and this is going to be a painful consequence, because here's a man that loves agriculture and raising plants, and he probably has a nice garden, and God's going to not deny him the right to do that anymore. You're now denied your occupation in agriculture, and you're going to have to go and find some other way to make a living. It's going to be hard to make a living. And a fugitive and a vagabond you will be on the earth. You're going to wander around now away from your family. Adam and Eve have other sons and daughters, by the way. In the case of Adam and Eve, we could count at least 7 children. If you do the arithmetic of how quickly people multiplied when you live 900 years, by the time Adam died, he had at least 100,000 descendants. Could have easily had 1 million descendants. That just simple mathematics will figure that out. So pretty soon, Cain and Abel had brothers and sisters running around, and the brothers and sisters married and had children, and Cain had a wife, and there's plenty of people around. So after a few years, everybody knows Cain's a murderer, and some of the family members are going to get together and say, "We got to go get that Cain. He killed our little brother Abel." So there's going to be plenty of desire for revenge. And this is what Cain is concerned about. He says, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. I'm going to be hounded and hunted down, and I'm going to be a nomad constantly in hiding." Of course, he's also got all that guilt in his heart that's not been dealt with, and that alone makes a person fearful and wants to hide. The Lord, however, verse 14, "Surely you have driven me out this day from the face of the ground. I shall be hidden from your face. I'll be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth. And it will happen that anyone who finds me will kill me." That's reasonable. That's probably true. We don't have any courts in the early world. It's a patriarchal society. There isn't any law enforcement. Everybody would take justice into his or her own hands at the right time or convene a family council. And surely before a family council, he'd be found guilty and his life forfeited. But God says, no, that's not what's going to happen to you. I'm going to protect you. The Lord said to him, "Therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance shall be on him sevenfold." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest anyone finding him should kill him. And then mark of protection. I don't know what kind of mark that is, invisible or what it was. But God says, no, I'm going to protect you for a long period of time in hopes that you might change your mind and come to me. That's Romans 2. God's kindness is meant to lead you to repentance. But God doesn't come crashing down on us with judgment immediately. He gives us grace and mercy and waits and hopes and is kind to us and protects us in the hopes that we will come to know him. No record whatsoever of Cain ever repenting or ever coming to the Lord, or any of his children either. So this is a very beautiful indication that God is a God of long suffering, that judgment is long delayed, that God prefers mercy, that he would prefer to get the condemned murderer to accept his grace and forgiveness. He much prefers that path of healing and restoration. And so in the line of Cain, God waits patiently and delays the justice that's due to him. Cain went out from the presence of the Lord further east, and he dwelt in the land of Nod. Nod means wandering, east of Eden. That's a sort of sad story. He's an outcast from the family. He takes his wife and he runs off to the east. Everything's east here. And where did Cain get his wife? That's always number one question. Well, he married a sister or a cousin or something of that sort. And the genetic damage that we now carry around with us was very minimal back then, and there wasn't any particular prohibition. We're all brothers and sisters, so anytime you get married, you marry a brother or a sister. It's just that we're long, far removed from the closeness of the family in the garden. Now, what does he do? He goes out. Cain goes out and builds the very first city. He built the city, and he called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. There's two Enochs here. It turns out the archaic word Enoch is the oldest name we have for city. If you look back at ancient archaeology, ancient civilizations, Enoch means city. The first city ever built was built by a condemned murderer. After the flood, the first city that was built by Nimrod, who built Babylon, the city which becomes the wellspring of all the false religion in the world that gives rise to modern-day Iraq and is causing us problems in the news even now. So here's the interesting thing about the origin of the first two cities, the first city before the flood, the first city after the flood. And it kind of makes you stop and think, well, what is it like living in a city? And then at the end of the Bible, we have a wonderful city, the city of God, the New Jerusalem, which is going to be our eternal home. So here in the Bible starts this thread that Augustine picked up, city of God, city of man, these two cities. You think about all the things about cities that are exciting and convenient and beautiful and attractive. But think also of what happens, how hard it is to live in a city with the crime rates and all of the tenements and the poverty and all the corrupt business corporations that set up their headquarters in the city and all the things, the underworld in the city and all the prostitution and the drugs and the stuff that goes on in cities and all the violence and all and cities become very lonely places for people and how hard a time we have living in cities. So these are two themes that are starting here. And yet we're all going to end up in a great city. We're going to end up in the garden city of New Jerusalem one day. Now, suddenly we're going to get here. Now, we're going to get a very brief description that tells us just about all that we know about life before the flood. And in the line of Cain, we're going to get the six generations or so here, the next five generations, very briefly described for us. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad begot Mahujael. Mahujael begot Methushael. Methushael, that means God is dead. And Methushael begot Lamech. Lamech took two wives. First case of polygamy here. The name of the one was Ada, and the name of the other was Zillah. A to Z. Ray likes to comment that these wives provided him everything from A to Z. Now, this is obviously, this is in the line of Cain. This is in an ungodly line. And so we're getting murder, and now we've got bigamy, and we're going to get some more violence here. Ada bore Jabal. He was the father of all those who dwell in tents and have livestock. So we get some Bedouins and Mobile sheep herders back there. Hardly know anything about what this society was like. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the harp and the flute. Jubilee. We get Jubilee from that and that music. So you have to use your imagination here. We're getting cities. We're getting rock and roll and music and probably nice symphonies. And we get some Bedouin tribesmen that run around and maybe some Ringling Brothers circuses that go and entertain people and a great civilization. Zillah bore Tubal-Cain, an instructor in every craftsman in bronze and iron. That is industry and perhaps technology, building of things. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. You can look up the names of these people if you want to get a few little clues. Ray gives them in his commentary. There's this little poem that closes in this little section. Here's the writer, by the way, who's telling us all this is probably still Adam. Still Adam's diary. We'll get to the end of Adam's diary in a minute. And he obviously would have lost track with Cain pretty soon, probably. Cain's wandered off. No email. I don't know what kind of postal service they had in those days or whether the descendants of Cain ever came back to see their parents and their a family reunion. If you get 100,000 or 200,000 relatives, then you can imagine the problem at Christmas time and cards. Mom has to sit down and send a card every time a grandchild is born. We're going to get the whole culture is a very radically different world when people live 900 years. It's very foreign to us. Imagine that. You don't start having children till you're 100, and then you have four or five children, and apparently that's all you have. Was there any birth control? I don't have any idea. There's a real problem if you have more than five or six children per family, and that means that the world population would explode out of all reasonable limits within 1,000, 2,000 years. So they weren't huge families. That people must have been very, very healthy if they lived 900 years. They must have been very, very intelligent. How long would it take for you to get through college? You'd probably get through college and pretty early on. You have all those productive years. You get together, you could have long conversations with your friends. If you sat down for 6 months and had lunch, that wouldn't be any big deal. Think of the knowledge that was passed on down from one generation to another and the amount of information. And these are very, very intelligent people. We're not more advanced. We're way down on the ladder of deterioration with our 70 or 80 years of poor quality living. And this is, so this is a civilization of very sophisticated people. Now, the whole line of Cain, it appears to be a very ungodly line, very incredibly ungodly, and it's going to get so bad that God will move in to destroy this whole civilization. Verse 23, Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. O wives of Lamech, listen to my speech. I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. So Lamech is boasting about the fact that he got in a fight down at the nearby nightclub one evening, and somebody wounded him or injured him in a fight, and he killed the guy. Out and out, murdered him. If Cain is avenged 70-fold, Lamech is avenged 77-fold. So he's taunting God there. He's looking back at what happened to Cain and Cain's murder, and he says, well, I can do better than that. I was only wounded. I wasn't provoked, and I killed this guy, and so I'm getting 77-fold vengeance on my enemy by putting him to death, taking justice in my own hand. So that's all kind of a suggestion of the twisted, distorted values that existed now six generations after Cain. And then the record breaks off right there. That's all we learn about the line of Cain. Millions and millions, billions and billions of people coming into existence, populating the world. What kind of an advanced civilization did they build? Advanced, but corrupt and decadent. How much violence was there? How much people apparently didn't get sick quite as often. There wasn't as many diseases. If you've got 900 years of useful life, there could have been a lot of violence and murder, of which this just hints. But maybe technology, maybe art, music, culture, literature, books. Maybe a bunch of books got put in Noah's Ark, and if we were ever to find the Ark, which we probably won't, then maybe we'd learn something. We know nothing about this whole antediluvian period. It's just really a shame that God wasn't more thoughtful here to give us, because you just whet your appetite when you start to think about these things a little bit. Yes, I think I don't think the length of the day or the length of the year changed any at all. There's no reason to think that from any kind of records. So I think these are just our regular years. Now, we can talk about what happens later at the time of the flood. Now, Cain has gone off with his wife. Abel has been murdered. Abel was the one who was righteous, so you'd naturally hope that he would have children, and maybe their children would know the Lord, but that didn't happen. And so now Adam knows his wife again. And Adam and Eve now have their third child. As far as we know, it's the third child. And this child is named Seth. Seth means appointed. And Eve, the mother of all living, says, God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. And Seth gets homeschooled, and he comes to know the Lord, and he turns out to be righteous. And so we're going to have, and Adam and Eve die, they're going to have at least one son who's walking with the Lord, and probably some other sons and daughters. So we're going to have a godly remnant of survivors that will pass the message of the gospel on down to the next generation. And we'll get some vigorous evangelism here. Seth grew up, became 100 or so years old, and had a son. And his name was Enosh. And in the days of Enosh, men began to call on the name of the Lord. That's a strange little scripture. I asked Bob Rowe what that meant, and Bob Rowe's always very right. He says he thinks this is the time when human beings, godly people, began to get together for the first corporate worship. Began to collectively call on the name of the Lord. Instead of individually walking with God, that people begin to gather together for music, for singing, for worship, for instruction. So we have here perhaps the first time that God is known by an assembly of people gathering together. That makes sense. And a small number of the people born on the world are going to respond to the call of God and listen to the call of God and represent the people who are redeemed. We'll get to meet them someday in heaven, and we pick up the rest of this story up there when we talk to these people. verse chapter 5, verse 1, this is the book of the genealogy of Adam. That's our little clue, which occurs 11 times in Genesis, that marks a section break. And I was going to suggest there are two points of view, that this is either closes a chapter or opens a chapter. I'm going to suggest that this closes Adam's diary. That verse 5, chapter 5, verse 1 belongs with the previous chapter. This is the book of the genealogy of Adam. This is the end of Adam's diary. Adam signed his name. This document's going to get passed on down. It'll get to Moses sometime. Moses will have this document and weave it into the inspired account of Genesis. Now, that's my hypothesis that's fairly well accepted nowadays. Now, then, this means that the next section, which starts right here, is not written by Adam, but it's written by probably Seth. Seth starts a diary. Going to run on a little bit longer, and he's going to have some information, and he's going to tell us about everything that he knows and writes it down. So it'll be there when Moses compiles this theory. If that's so, in the day that God created man, Seth says, God made man in the likeness of God. So, thinking back to creation, that Adam and Eve are made in the likeness of God, he created them, male and female, and blessed them and called them mankind, Adam. That's generic. It means man and woman. It's always generic. Called them man in the day that they were created. That looks right back to the origin of man again and confirms it. And now we get a little bit of the details. This is a sort of depressing chapter because every section here ends up with the little terms, and he died. And he died, and he died. Now, this shows how disastrous the ruin of the human race has been, because we started by talking about life and eternal life and gardens and paradise, and now we're going to get this list of obituaries. And, of course, why are these here at all? Well, they're here because God put them there for several reasons, one of which is going to show the continuity all the way down to Jesus. So there's going to be a continuity that starts here with Adam and Seth that takes us all the way. If we trace it far enough, we'll get to Jesus a little bit further on down the line. We will get to the promised seed of the woman. Adam lived 130 years and begot a son in his own likeness. There's a switch there. Adam was made in the likeness of God. His sons are made in the likeness of Adam. You are made in the likeness of your father. You still carry the image of God with you, but you cannot escape the fact that you are genetically and in many ways in behavior, you're like your parents. You've got the genetic heritage that from Adam came down through the channel of your parents, so you carry the likeness of your parents to some degree. Adam lived 130 years, and he begot a son in his own likeness, and after his image, and named him Seth. Well, Seth's the third born, so the other two children were born a little early, but it's kind of funny. They didn't have children until they were about 100 years old. We're all dead and gone by that time in life. Now, look what happens in this record. He begot Seth. After he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years, during which time he begot other sons and daughters. Sons, plural, daughters, plural. That means at least four, five, six, seven. Seven children minimum. Maybe more. Okay? And all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. And he died. All these sections are going to close with that little, and he died. 930 years. Seth lived 105 years. That's the gets up to the age you have children. And he begot Enosh, and Seth lived an additional 807 years. And he begot sons, plural, and daughters, plural, at least five children. And all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. Enosh lived 90 years, and he begot Canaan. After he begot, he married young, didn't he? He had children really young. After he begot Canaan, Enosh lived 815 years, and he begot sons and daughters, and all the days of Enosh were 905 years, and he died. Canaan lived 70 years and begot Mahalalel. After he begot Mahalalel, Canaan lived 840 years, and he begot sons and daughters. And all the days of Canaan were 910 years, and he died. Mahalalel lived 65 years, and he begot Jared. And after he begot Jared, Mahalalel lived 830 years and begot sons and daughters. And all the days of Mahalalel were 895 years, and he died. Jared lived 162 years and begot Enoch, different Enoch. After he begot Enoch, Jared lived 800 years and begot sons and daughters, and all the days of Jared were 962 years, and he died. We have 10 generations in here, by the way, and if you add these numbers up literally, and these numbers here are based on the Masoretic text, you'll get 1,656 years, with probably no gaps in here, probably no missing names. We know that because the New Testament says Enoch is the seventh from Adam. 1,656 years, if you take the Septuagint or you take other versions of the Hebrew, you'll get as much as 2,256 years from Adam to Noah, which is a slightly longer period of time. I've given you a couple charts, but it's absolutely amazing how the world population soars from two people up to billions of people in this short time period. World population by the time of the flood is going to be billions of people, which is staggering to think about. Nice climate, favorable conditions for life, healthy people. I don't know whether out of this these numbers you can get extremely large world populations. Now something happens at Enoch, seventh from Adam. Enoch lived 65 years old to age 65 and had a son really early, and his son's name was Methuselah. And after he begot Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years, and he begot sons and daughters, and all the days of Enoch were 365 years, and Enoch walked with God, and he was not found, for God took him. Well, now something funny goes on here in the life of this man, Enoch. We know from the New Testament that he was a preacher of righteousness. We know in the New Testament, in Jude, that God gave him a great vision of what was going to happen. And Jude says, Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men, false teachers, saying, behold, the Lord will come with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment on all, to convict all who are ungodly among them of all their ungodly deeds which they have committed in an ungodly way. So Enoch was given a picture of the second coming of Jesus, the final ultimate judgment. He saw that. Enoch is a preacher, an evangelist, as Noah was. So some of these men that are in this list are going to be influential men who are busy letting the gospel go out into the whole world. So a good number of people, even people in the line of Cain, are going to come to the Lord. We're going to finally allow people to go onto the boat. That comes up a little bit later. Now, what happened here when Enoch had a son, and his name is Methuselah, which means when he dies, it will come. So Enoch is minding his business, preaching the gospel, and he has this son, and God says, name him, when he dies, it will come. That means that when this boy dies, we're going to have a judgment on this civilization, and the flood's going to come. And Enoch was jolted into reality, and he began to walk with God as closely as he possibly knew how. So he didn't die. He just got to the point where he walked right on home to heaven. He was translated. Raptured. He was caught right up, went home. One of two men in the Old Testament who didn't die. The other being Elijah. And so now we've got this little boy Methuselah growing up, and Ray Stedman likes to point out, you'd think everybody's going to worry about Methuselah if he sneezes or falls off his bicycle or something goes on, and because when he dies, the judgment's going to come. So everybody's watching this guy's health. I'm sure they're very careful about his health because he's an omen of what's going to happen, and his parents guard him. He lives longer than anybody else that ever lived. He lives 969 years, so he's the oldest man that ever lived, and that's how patient and loving and merciful God is. But when Methuselah died, the flood came, okay? And this man Enoch is a very remarkable Old Testament antediluvian man, a preacher, evangelist, who got to look ahead at the second coming that we haven't even hardly understand now. Methuselah lived 187 years. His first son's born late. He bore the son Lamech. After he begot Lamech, Methuselah lived 782 years and had other sons and daughters. And all the days of Methuselah were 962 years, and he died. His son Lamech lived 182 years and begot a son and called his name Noah, which means comfort, rest, comfort. Called his name Noah, saying, "This one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed." After he begot Noah, Lamech lived 595 years, and he begot other sons and daughters. And all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. So he died a little younger, only 777 when he died. And then we meet the man Noah, the tenth from Adam. Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begot, in short order, three sons, Shem, Ham, Japheth. They're always named in that order in the Bible, Shem, Ham, Japheth, but that's not the order in which they were born. Who was the firstborn? That's a lesson we could do I'll tell you, but you could go figure it out from the New Testament, from elsewhere. Japheth's the firstborn, and Shem is the secondborn, and Ham is the thirdborn. These are going to be the sons of Noah that survived the flood, along with Noah and their wives, eight people. So the whole world is going to be repopulated by the sons of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And that means that everybody in this room then is a descendant of Noah and also a descendant of one of these three boys, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And this will be something we'll talk about, the three branches of the human race. I'm really quite interested in recent scientific discoveries that say that the whole human race is genetically one race. That's now pretty well scientifically established. The other interesting thing is the geneticists are noticing that there was a throttling down in the human genetic characteristics at some point, at which the human race seems to have been reduced down to a very small number and then grew back up again. I wonder when that happened. I wonder how that took place. Now, Ray Stedman is often quoted by others, but he says the following. In summarizing this list of names of the descendants of Seth, this is generally the godly line of Seth. We assume that these men were all believers, that they were men who influenced the gospel and brought the gospel out into the world. Lots of people came to the Lord by grace, just like we do. Who knows how many millions or billions we'll see in heaven when we get there, and we'll certainly meet these people. Now, these names all have meaning, and I've read them quickly. And Ray says, a way of escape is indicated again in a most fascinating way in this chapter by the meaning of the names listed. There's some difference among authorities as to the meaning of these names, depending on the root from which they are judged to be taken. But one authority gives the most interesting sequence of meanings. The list begins with Seth, which means appointed. Enosh, his son, means mortal. His son Kenan means sorrow. His son Mahalalel means the blessed God. He named his boy Jared, which means came down, and his boy Enoch means teaching, and Methuselah, as we saw, means his death shall bring. Lamech means strength, and Noah means comfort. Put all these together, God has appointed that mortal man shall sorrow, but the blessed God came down, teaching that his death shall bring strength and comfort. Is this book from God? God has given you and me a life to watch, just as Methuselah's generation watched his. It is your life. God has written Methuselah on each one of us. His death shall bring it, or when he dies it will come. How far is it till the end of the world for you when you die? That's the end of the world. That's the end of man's day. Is it 50 years from now? 10? Tomorrow? Who knows? At any moment, when he dies, it will come. That's Ray Stedman, 1968. Okay, neat little chapters here, aren't they? And short little summary. Comments? Questions?
God's
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, and next time when we find out about the building of the ark, we'll find that God gets issues another warning that he's giving the world 120 years of warning before the judgment, during which time Adam gets to build his boat, and Adam gets to invite everybody anywhere to come on board the boat. Plenty of room. And this is going to be the place that you'll be safe from the coming judgment. And how many people flock to get on board the boat? Nobody. And Crazy Noah preaches this message of God's impending judgment for 100 years. In today's notes, I gave you Barry Setterfield's chronology. I don't like the 4004 B.C. Archbishop Usher 16th century date for the creation, April 14th, 4004 B.C. If you add up some of these numbers, 4004 is sort of what you get B.C. I'd prefer something like 6000 B.C., sort of like approximately. And my reasoning is as follows. My reasoning is that these names are pretty well connected. There aren't any missing ones that we know of. Arthur Custance did a lot of study on that. If there are a few missing, it doesn't make an awful lot of difference. Adam could not have lived very long ago. I think that dating of things like the pyramids at 2600 B.C. is probably reasonable, sort of, approximately. I think the flood, my date for the flood here is 3500 B.C., sort of like. And I'm going to put creation at 6,000 B.C. and have that be very, very tentative. So I'm saying the earth is only 8,000 years old. Over on the right-hand column of this, my favorite chronology by my friend Barry Setterfield are the atomic dates based on the speed of light slowing down. So the date of creation would be 10 million years ago in atomic time. So Now, the reason that I believe in a young, recent creation is on this internal evidence from Adam to Jesus. Remember when we talked about Genesis 1, I was willing to throw everything up in the air and say, well, this seems to be prehistory. This seems to kind of be out of time. It's pretty hard to, there's no definite date indicated. So if you want to talk about history, we'll talk about Adam. So I think Adam lived about 6,000 B.C., about 8,000 years ago, approximately. The other chart I gave you in here, I gave you a chart of population growth. I have two articles on my website. If you want to do your own population growth calculations, it's kind of fun. You can take a pocket calculator or spreadsheet and plug in various numbers for how many children people have. And I show suggested world population since the creation, and you notice how it soars up to a big peak at the time of the flood. And I sort of arbitrarily said there were 9 billion people before the flood. Maybe it was 2 billion, maybe it was 30 billion, a lot of people. Look what's happened after the flood. We know pretty well the world population in the time of Christ was about 200 million. Most everybody agrees that's about right. 200 million, 300 million. And we have pretty good data from the time of Christ up to the present. Look where the population is right now. Look where we are on this curve. Suggest anything to your wild imagination about where we are in history? It sort of does to me. It suggests that history's that the population is soaring again and doubling very quickly, and then now you get into all the opinions of what's the sustainable population of the earth, how many people can we feed here, and then the population control people are all talking about how do we get this curve to level off, how do we get rid of extra people and increase food production, and you know that's why there's been an awful lot of talk about birth controls and euthanasia and things like that. It's this steep curve over here. So that, to me, this is pretty ominous evidence that we're probably pretty near the end of the age. Plus the technological bubble. If you think about human beings being farmers, raising crops and raising animals for thousands and thousands of years and feeding themselves, it's only since about 1900 that we've had the surplus to go build automobiles and airplanes and computers and technology and all the conveniences of life. And How many people in the United States now are involved in food production? Well, not very many. It's not 100% anymore. It's like 5 or 10%. Well, that's very interesting that the whole world should change so rapidly in 100 years. And you get this big technological explosion. Was there a similar technological explosion before the flood? What happened in those days right before the flood that made the whole civilization so out of control that God wiped it all out? Because they weren't repentant. They must have been a very advanced civilization. Now, where's the archaeology that proves it? Well, the flood was very devastating, as we'll see. I think the remnants of the cities before the flood are buried under thousands of feet of sediments. I don't think we have anything that any archaeology that shows what it was like on Earth before the flood. Unless, of course, they find Noah's Ark. Haven't found it. Oh, I think a good number of these people were all believers. I think they were Noah, Enoch, Adam, Eve, Seth. Now, there's a little passage in Peter where it says that which people use to suggest that Jesus descended into hell. And I don't think he descended into hell, but it does suggest there that that by means of the Holy Spirit, the gospel was preached before the flood to the world before the flood. So I think Peter lets us know that the message of God's grace went out into that ancient world, as it does in every generation. And so people had a chance to come to know the Lord the way we do. By the end of the age, we only end up with 8. No, I don't. I have a whole article on my website on that. It's just a very difficult translation. He went right home to be with the Father, I think.
Maybe if I could speculate this. If we're going through a technological bubble now, I guess it's safe to say that maybe there was a technological bubble before the flood.
Maybe.
And so the construction of the ark would have been pretty easy.
It's evidently handmade, and it evidently took about 100 years, and he hired some laborers from off the streets or something. It's a big boat. But it wasn't high tech. It wasn't welded, and it was made out of wood, and it was caulked with asphalt. So maybe they didn't decide to go the route of high tech. Maybe they were interested in music and art and literature and other areas of knowledge and human endeavor. All we have is this little hint of bronze and iron, forging and metal and music. Those are and plenty of violence. I don't know, Steve. Now, Cain's family would have gone off and lived in cities, but the line of Seth may have stayed Bedouins and nomads. Yeah.
Would you put the dinosaurs prior to Adam?
Yes, outside the garden, created on the sixth day. And so, remember, outside the garden is an area that's unexplored, that Adam had to take care of the garden, but after that he had the whole world to manage. So he had to go out and find the mineral resources and study the animals and be a steward over the whole planet and manage the resources of the planet. And a lot of that would have been undeveloped. The garden was developed, but outside the garden there's a frontier. You notice how we kind of have run out of frontiers in recent years. When the U.S. was expanding, we had frontiers. We had the whole Midwest and then the West to conquer. And in the early days of sailing, we had the whole world to explore. And we kind of ran out of frontiers. So now we got space, the final frontier. Only that's proving to be kind of expensive and difficult and vain, maybe. Chris? F post flood. No. We don't build pyramids anymore. Yes.
Methuselah has two names. Methuselah and Methuselah.
Yeah. I don't know. You could probably look that up. The M-U-T-H, Muth, is death. You can look that up and tell us. Yeah. There'd be the radioactive dating time if you did radiocarbon dating. The atomic clock. And I've suggested that previously that the atomic clock has slowed down with respect to the regular calendar by... Yeah. I think so. Yes. That's a very good point. I think that there was no radioactive decay before the fall. Right now, you're getting bombarded with cosmic rays, and all the time, cosmic rays are flooding the room. Every once in a while, a cosmic ray will come along and hit some of your genetic material and produce a birth defect. And if you marry a close relative, the odds are a genetic defect would line up, and you shouldn't marry a close relative. That's one reason. We have a lot of genetic damage. Why the lifetimes dropped? I think I gave you the chart in there too. I gave you the chart of the longevity of the patriarchs, how long people lived, and then the way it declined after the flood. It drops down in a more or less... Nobody understands why that's... I've never seen anybody explain why that happened that way. God did it. I mean, that certainly is true. I also think the second law of thermodynamics was not in effect before the fall, that the universe was being renewed all the time, and God now lets it run down, fall apart, decay as a consequence of human sin. I don't see radiation as being beneficial to life, especially, radiation generally makes the genetic damage. So I think the radioactive decay started up. Now that means that when you turn on radioactive decay, then the short-lived radioactive elements decay quickly, and so you get a lot of heat. And I think there would have been a lot of heat by the time of the flood, so that the Earth's crust could very well have been plastic and fluid about that time. And that would allow the Earth's continent to break up quickly. Speculation. Yeah. Must be an amazingly different quality of life.
Yeah.
This Arthur Custance, again, this is one of the subjects that interested him, was psychological time. And time's been damaged because the quality of time that we have now is sort of ruined. You know, you have a good day and a bad day, and sometimes you're bored and you waste time, and we never have enough time, or time's on our hands, and so something's messed up in the psychological perception of time. And I think before the flood, if you were going to live 900 years, it must have been the way you dealt with things would have been different. Imagine not having any children until you're 100. How come they didn't have thousands of children? If you've got 600 or 700 years of useful life-bearing years, I don't know.